Chapter 11. She was aware of his taking her hand, and of feeling that his touch was lifeless. Goodbye. He turned away, and stopped on the threshold. Who'll say goodbye for me to Verena? She heard the closing of the outer door, and the sound of his quick tread along the path. The latch of the gate clicked after him. The next morning when she arose in the cold dawn, and opened her shutters, she saw a freckled boy standing on the other side of the road and looking up at her. He was a boy from a farm 3 or 4 miles down the Creston Road, and she wondered what he was doing there at that hour, and why he looked so hard at her window. When he saw her, he crossed over and leaned against the gate unconcernedly. There was no one stirring in the house, and she threw a shawl over her nightgown, and ran down, and let herself out. By the time she reached the gate, the boy was sauntering down the road, whistling carelessly. But she saw that a letter had been thrust between the slats and the crossbar of the gate. She took it out and hastened back to her room. The envelope bore her name, and inside was a leaf torn from a pocket diary. Dear Charity, I can't go away like this. I am staying for a few days at Creston River. Will you come down and meet me at Creston Pool? I will wait for you till evening. X. Charity sat before the mirror trying on a hat which Eli Hawes, with much secrecy, had trimmed for her. It was of white straw, with a drooping brim and cherry-colored lining that made her face glow like the inside of the shell on the parlor mantelpiece. She propped the square of looking glass against Mr. Royal's black leather Bible, steadying it in front with a white stone on which a view of the Brooklyn Bridge was painted, and she sat before her reflection, bending the brim this way and that, while Eli Hawes' pale face looked over her shoulder like the ghost of wasted opportunities. I look awful, don't I? She said at last with a happy sigh. Eli smiled and took back the hat. LL stitched the roses on right here, so you can put it away at once. Charity laughed, and ran her fingers through her rough dark hair. She knew that Harney liked to see its reddish edges ruffled about her forehead and breaking into little rings at the nape. She sat down on her bed, and watched Eli stoop over the hat with a careful frown. Don't you ever feel like going down to Nettleton for a day? She asked. Eli shook her head without looking up. Oh, I always remember that awful time I went down with Julia to that doctor's. Oh, Eli, I can't help it. The house is on the corner of Wing Street and Lake Avenue. The trolley from the station goes right by it, and the day the minister took us down to see those pictures I recognized it right off, and couldn't seem to see anything else. There's a big black sign with gold letters all across the front, private consultations. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she came, as near as anything to dying. Dot, dot. Poor Julia. Charity sighed from the height of her purity and her security. S.E. had a friend whom she trusted, and who respected her. She was going with him to spend the next day, the 4th of July, at Nettleton. Whose business was it but hers, and what was the harm? The pity of it was that girls like Julia did not know how to choose, and to keep bad fellows at a distance. Charity slipped down from the bed, and stretched out her hands. Is it sewed? Let me try it on again. She put the hat on, and smiled at her image. The thought of Julia had vanished. The next morning she was up before dawn, and saw the yellow sunrise broaden behind the hills, and the silvery luster preceding a hot day tremble across the sleeping fields. Her plans had been made with great care. As he had announced that she was going down to the Band of Hope picnic at Hepburn, and as no one else from North Dormer intended to venture so far, it was not likely that her absence from the festivity would be reported. Besides, if it were, she would not greatly care. She was determined to assert her independence, and if she stooped to fib about the Hepburn picnic, it was chiefly from the secretive instinct that made her dread the profanation of her happiness. Whenever she was with Lucius Harney, she would have liked some impenetrable mountain mist to hide her. It was arranged that she should walk to a point of the Creston Road, where Arnie was to pick her up and drive her across the hills to Hepburn in time for the 9:30 train to Nettleton. Arnie at first had been rather lukewarm about the trip. He declared himself ready to take her to Nettleton, but urged her not to go on the 4th of July, on account of the crowds, the probable lateness of the trains, the difficulty of her getting back before night. But her evident disappointment caused him to give way, and even to affect a faint enthusiasm for the adventure. She understood why he was not more eager. He must have seen sights beside which even a 4th of July at Nettleton would seem tame. But as he had never seen anything, and a great longing possessed her to walk the streets of a big town on a holiday, clinging to his arm and jostled by idle crowds in their best clothes. The only cloud on the prospect was the fact that the shops would be closed, but she hoped he would take her back another day when they were open. She started out unnoticed in the early sunlight, slipping through the kitchen while Verena bent above the stove. To avoid attracting notice, she carried her new hat carefully wrapped up, and had thrown a long gray veil of Mrs. Royal's over the new white muslin dress which Ally's clever fingers had made for her. All of the $10 Mr. Royal had given her, and a part of her own savings as well, had been spent on renewing her wardrobe. And when Arnie jumped out of the buggy to meet her, she read her reward in his eyes. The freckled boy who had brought her the note 2 weeks earlier was to wait with the buggy at Hepburn till their return. He perched at Charity's feet, his legs dangling between the wheels, and they could not say much because of his presence. But it did not greatly matter, for their past was now rich enough to have given them a private language, and with the long day stretching before them like the blue distance beyond the hills, there was a delicate pleasure in postponement. When Charity, in response to Arnie's message, had gone to meet him at the Creston Pool, her heart had been so full of mortification and anger that his first words might easily have estranged her. But it happened that he had found the right word, which was one of simple friendship. His tone had instantly justified her and put her guardian in the wrong. He had made no allusion to what had passed between Mr. Royal and himself, but had simply let it appear that he had left because means of conveyance were hard to find at North Dormer, and because Creston River was a more convenient center. He told her that he had hired by the week the buggy of the freckled boy's father, who served as livery stable keeper to one or two melancholy summer boarding houses on Creston Lake, and had discovered, within driving distance, a number of houses worthy of his pencil, and he said that he could not, while he was in the neighborhood, give up the pleasure of seeing her as often as possible. When they took leave of each other, she promised to continue to be his guide, and during the fortnight which followed they roamed the hills in happy comradeship. In most of the village, friendships between youths and maidens' lack of conversation was made up for by tentative fondling. But Arnie, except when he had tried to comfort her in her trouble on their way back from the Hyatts, had never put his arm about her, or sought to betray her into any sudden caress. It seemed to be enough for him to breathe her nearness like a flower's. And since his pleasure at being with her, and his sense of her youth and her grace, perpetually shone in his eyes, and softened the inflection of his voice, his reserve did not suggest coldness, but the deference due to a girl of his own class. The buggy was drawn by an old trotter who whirled them along so briskly that the pace created a little breeze, but when they reached Hepburn the full heat of the airless morning descended on them. At the railway station the platform was packed with a sweltering throng, and they took refuge in the waiting room, where there was another throng, already dejected by the heat and the long waiting for retarded trains. Pale mothers were struggling with fretful babies, or trying to keep their older offspring from the fascination of the track. Girls and their fellows were giggling and shoving, and passing about candy in sticky bags, and older men, collarless and perspiring, were shifting heavy children from one arm to the other, and keeping a haggard eye on the scattered members of their families. At last the train rumbled in, and engulfed the waiting multitude. Hardy swept Charity up onto the first car and they captured a bench for two, and sat in happy isolation, while the train swayed and roared along through rich fields and languid tree clumps. The haze of the morning had become a sort of clear tremor over everything, like the colorless vibration about a flame, and the opulent landscape seemed to droop under it. But to Charity the heat was a stimulant. It enveloped the whole world in the same glow that burned at her heart. Now and then a lurch of the train flung her against Harney, and through her thin muslin she felt the touch of his sleeve. She steadied herself, their eyes met, and the flaming breath of the day seemed to enclose them. The train roared into the Nettleton station, the descending mob caught them on its tide, and they were swept out into a vague moldy square thronged with seedy hacks, and long curtained omnibuses drawn by horses with tasseled fly nets over their withers, who stood swinging their depressed heads drearily from side to side. A mob of bus and hack drivers were shouting, "Oh, the Eagle House, to the Washington House, this way to the lake, just starting for Grey Top," and through their yells came the popping of firecrackers, the explosion of torpedoes, the banging of toy guns, and the crash of a fireman's band trying to play the Merry Widow while they were being packed into a wagonette streaming with bunting. The ramshackle wooden hotels about the square were all hung with flags and paper lanterns, and as Harney and Charity turned into the main street, with its brick and granite business blocks crowding out the old low-storied shops, and its towering poles strung with innumerable wires that seemed to tremble and buzz in the heat, they saw the double line of flags and lanterns tapering away gaily to the park at the other end of the perspective. The noise and color of this holiday vision seemed to transform Nettleton into a metropolis. Charity could not believe that Springfield, or even Boston, had anything grander to show, and she wondered if, at this very moment, Annabel Balch, on the arm of as brilliant a young man, were threading her way through scenes as resplendent. "Where shall we go first?" Harney asked. But as she turned her happy eyes on him, he guessed the answer and said, "We'll take a look round, shall we?" The street swarmed with their fellow travelers, with other excursionists arriving from other directions, with Nettleton's own population, and with the mill hands trooping in from the factories on the Creston. The shops were closed, but one would scarcely have noticed it, so numerous were the glass doors swinging open on saloons, on restaurants, on drug stores gushing from every soda water tap, on fruit and confectionery shops stacked with strawberry cake, coconut drops, trays of glistening molasses candy, boxes of caramels and chewing gum, baskets of sodden strawberries, and dangling branches of bananas. Outside of some of the doors were trestles with banked up oranges and apples, spotted pears and moldy raspberries. And the air reeked with the smell of fruit and stale coffee, beer, and sarsaparilla and fried potatoes. Even the shops that were closed offered, through wide expanses of plate glass, hints of hidden riches. In some, waves of silk and ribbon broke over shores of imitation moss from which ravishing hats rose like tropical orchids. In others, the pink throats of gramophones opened their giant convolutions in a soundless chorus, or bicycles shining in neat ranks seemed to await the signal of an invisible starter, or tiers of fancy goods in leatherette and paste and celluloid dangled their insidious graces, and, in one vast bay that seemed to project them into exciting contact with the public, wax ladies in daring dresses chatted elegantly, or, with gestures intimate, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.